Francis Stewart is my latest guest in this series of nostalgia interviews. Francis is Implicit Religion Research Fellow at Bishop Grotesque University in Lincoln. We talk about growing up in Northern Ireland, moving to Scarborough. We discover why she and her fellow students didn't want to graduate at York Cathedral. We talk about implicit religion and punk rock and Francis's book, Punk Rock is My Religion and Straight Edge Punk, how her earliest memories involve a record player and a fireplace and her grandmother singing along to Boney M. We find out what it was like to grow up in Northern Ireland and how religion was used as a political tool. We talk about growing up below the poverty line, but having an enjoyable childhood, albeit against the backdrop of bomb scares. We find out about how her earliest memories involved jumping up and down in the cot to Status Quo. She was into John Peel and punk music. We talk about Live Aid and John Craven's Newsround. How Frances entered university. How she ended up studying in Stirling. She remembers the miners' strike of the mid-1980s. We talk about how engaged students are now. We talk about the use of religion in superhero films. We talk about whether she is an optimistic person, how we can find meaning in trauma. What would have happened if she'd become a tattoo artist, which is what she once wanted to be? We find out what would have happened if Frances had been told at the age of 15 what she would be doing now. We learn whether she is a looking back or a looking forward type of person, and whether we do really need nostalgia. It was a huge pleasure to interview Frances Stewart for the latest in my series of nostalgia interviews. My name is Chris DC. Well, it's an absolute pleasure to be in Lincoln with Frances Stewart, who we met at an implicit religion conference, of course, many years ago. That's very much your field.
It is, yes.
And you were, of course, in Scotland before coming down here.
Yes, at Stirling, University of Stirling. I was a teaching fellow there. And I came down here at the end of August to start a new post at Bishop Grotesque.
Yeah. And so, yeah, implicit religion is very much how I know you. So we have lots of research, you know, shared interests that no doubt will come up in the conversation. But tell me a little bit about your background, Frances, in terms of when and where you were born.
I was born in Northern Ireland, just outside Belfast, the very end of the 1970s. I can't remember. I think it's Oudenard I was born in, or Dundonald. I honestly can't remember.
But you were there.
You had
other things on your mind
at some point. I'm sure my mother could tell you. I was born then. I was raised in Northern Ireland. We never moved out of it, although we did move around quite a bit. We went to the very north up to Portrush for a while. We lived in Ballymena, which was horrible. Nobody should live in Ballymena. Belfast, Bangor, different areas. But if I introduce myself, I generally just say I'm from Belfast because that's the place people know, and that's sort of the area I know the best. I left there when I was 18 to attend university in Yorkshire. So I was part of the University of York, but my campus was Scarborough. So it was University College Scarborough, which was owned by York at the time, because they had to separate out religion and theology. One cannot contaminate the other, was the words they used. But at the time, you couldn't do world religions in Northern Ireland. You could only do Christian theology. And generally speaking, you only did that which you were, Protestant or Catholic. And I wanted to do world religion, so I had to go over to England. And I never really went back.
It's funny, this demarcation, though, isn't it, between religion and theology? Because there are some departments, and I've worked in some of them, where they will have the religious studies people on one corridor and the theology on the other. And, of course, a lot of people are more fluid than that.
Yes.
And people, you know, I've spent my whole career wondering which pigeonhole I should be put into. But to actually be on separate campuses, was that because that the staff wouldn't talk to each other?
Or was I honestly don't know. I don't know if it was historical or if it was just because York had bought over this other campus and decided that was because they already had religious studies there, that was the easiest place to put them. I'm really not sure. We always just thought it was funny. The only time we protested was when it came to graduation. We wouldn't graduate at York Cathedral. We wanted to graduate in Scarborough. Mm-hmm. We thought that's where we should be. That's what where we'd had our memories and where we'd had our lectures and all of our fun. That was really the only time it became an issue. But yeah, the demarcation is incredibly interesting because we do it in so many aspects of our lives. You know, sometimes unconsciously, sometimes deliberately.
And do you think that's fed into your research at all, in terms of this whole question, which affects me on my day-to-day, in terms of, you know, category of religion questions, how we identify ourselves, but also more importantly, how other people see us? And, you know, I've had conversations with, very recently, somebody I went to university with who was trying to get me to designate myself, you know, are you a believer, are you a secular theologian, and all these sort of questions. And I thought, very interesting, because you can unpack a whole career in that.
You can, and then you also wonder, why does it matter to you what somebody else is? Yeah, I think, yes, it very much does, if I'm honest. So one of the reasons that I was so drawn to implicit religion was the fact that they don't situate themselves within theology or religious studies, that they're much more fluid. They don't really, as a network, they don't really take part in the whole religion theology debate. It's sort of, they know it's there, but it's not important to implicit religion. But my book was based on how do we actually navigate that debate and those demarcations when you're looking at something that is explicitly not religious. So for me, it was punk rock. So how do you talk about it in those terms? You can't necessarily lose the theological aspects, because they are making statements, you know, that it's salvific, that it has redemptive qualities. So you can't take away the theology, and yet they're talking about it like it's a religion. And then some interviewees would even say, punk rock was my religion. So I named the book after that. And there's songs that have that as their title as well. So yeah, those categories become incredibly interesting and incredibly important. But I think they also become important in terms of, where do you place yourself as an academic? Because you are trying to find a home. That's part of what being an academic is. And when you do something like punk rock or implicit religion, you don't really fit anywhere. So where does that home become? And then, just to add another layer to it, because I came to academia later, having had other careers, and I come with a punk identity, I don't quite fit in. And I'm very aware that I'm also very working class. So I don't quite fit in that way, so where is my home? But I'm not entirely just punk either. You know, I have this huge level of education, huge level of privilege. So, yeah, those demarcations then become very, very difficult.
And I really liked that book when I read it over the summer.
Thank you.
Because I was looking for something on the turn to the self, which is something that in my work in nostalgia is very much the sort of, you know, how do people designate themselves, often from a lay perspective, and what you were doing with people who were very suspicious sometimes, weren't they, that you were using the language, or maybe you weren't using the language of religion, because it was something that could be pejorative or deemed in that way. So you were trying to find what people's meaning systems were, if you like, their implicit religion, but without using the category of religion.
Absolutely. It's, the category of religion is constructed. You know, Tim Fitzgerald, he's right about that. I don't agree with all of his conclusions, but I do think he is right on that score. It is a constructed category, and therefore it only has the meanings we ascribe to it. And too often those are related to power. And who has power, who has privilege, and how do they use it? Mm-hmm. So yeah, once you deal with ordinary people who are often marginalised or oppressed or have various different backgrounds, those terms become really interesting.
And having a punk background and then studying punk and then interviewing people who are punks, in terms of how you categorise yourself and how other people perceive you, how has that changed over the years, both with family and people who are also like you, enjoying punk music and concerts and being on the circuit?
Yeah, that's a nice, easy question there. In terms of family, my family are very... How would I describe them? As children, we were always told to be ourselves. Both of my parents very strongly believe that you reach the child where they are and you allow them to become the person that they are meant to be. Yes, you have a responsibility in shaping that, but if there's something they're passionate about, as long as it's not, you know, axe murdering, then you go for it. So in that sense, I've never felt any sense of I can't do this or I shouldn't do that or whatever. I was who I was. That being said, because I'm specifically straight edge punk, that's not always understood within the family. You know, sort of very typical Irish family, and so the question, why don't you drink? You know. So that becomes interesting at times. I shared a flat with my brother for a year in Glasgow, I was doing my master's and he was doing his undergrad. And he made it his mission to try and see if he could sneak alcohol into any juice that I was drinking. Just because he thought it was funny. You know, and he didn't quite understand that actually, for me, choosing not to drink alcohol is similar to someone having a religious faith. You know, and he would never do something that would denigrate a religious faith, but he didn't understand it in that way. So yeah, it kind of things like that happen, but then, you know, siblings do that anyway, don't they?
Mm-hmm. But that was something that was very much in the news this week about veganism and,
yes,
you know, that whole question about respecting somebody's, yes, choices in a way that may not apply in the same way, mm-hmm, in terms of their faith identities, yeah, but it can be no less a faith, yeah, identity, which is...
And there was that whole debate of, you know, should we talk about veganism as a religion? Mm. Which I don't think it went anywhere. It was quite a circular debate, but, you know, it does raise those questions. Are those beliefs just as valid? You know, should they be treated in the same way? You know, the whole Piers Morgan response to the vegan sausage from, or sausage roll from Greggs. I mean, why does it bother you that something is being sold that you're not being forced to buy? Do you have shares in Greggs and you're worried they're going to fall? I don't get it. You know, so yeah, that whole thing of why does someone else's lifestyle choice that doesn't impact you in the slightest matter so much? And that becomes a huge issue then when you look at things like gender. Non-gender or non-binary individuals. Why are we so concerned about these things when actually whatever they're doing and whoever they're sleeping with is irrelevant to us anyway? You know, unless we are dating that person, it's none of our business and it doesn't impact on our life, so let them be.
And you certainly see the change of culture over recent years. I was talking to some of my students a few years ago who said, when it comes to gay marriage, for example, we're happy with it in the sense that we don't have the same hang-ups as our parents or grandparents do. And certainly when I was at university in the 90s, many friends of mine had a real problem with coming out, mm-hmm, because they were worried about the impact on people who, in some cases, yeah, you know, it was none of their business. But it's more, well, I don't think somebody would approve. It's like, well, so what?
Yeah.
Well, I think, but in a way that it did matter then. But these days, I think a lot of people are happier to say, well, this is my identity, this is who I am, yeah, and I have the statute book to back me up on,
yes,
this, rather,
absolutely,
than a sort of, you know, are we doing something illegal or something,
yeah,
that is transgressive. So it's interesting sometimes looking at the same question but from the vantage point of a different generation's,
yeah,
thinking.
Absolutely.
And the debate that I was having with my students a few years ago, it wouldn't have been possible to have with, you know, at the time when I was a student, mm-hmm, or at least it would have been framed in a very different way about who was breaking the law.
Yeah, I remember that conversation taking place when I was an undergrad. The head of our department was a defrocked priest. We all made up stories as to why he was defrocked. We don't actually know the reason. We had all sorts of wonderful stories. But he was defrocked priest, so he came at it from a very particular perspective. And one of the things that I can remember is there was somebody in the room, a young woman, and she was clearly uncomfortable at the conversation. And looking back now, she was obviously gay and didn't want to say that. But, you know, she didn't feel comfortable with that. She was very uncomfortable with the fact that it was being talked about in legal terms and then that it became about moral terms, you know, and Professor Dodd was very much, you know, this is wrong according to the church. There was no discussion on is the church right or wrong, it was just, no, that's what they say. You know, so yeah, I get what you mean there by the idea that the conversation changes and it develops over time, and that's the power of the youth, isn't it?
No, but I saw this really interesting interview with on the David Frost Sunday programme. It would have been in 1994, and I found it on either YouTube, maybe actually on the BBC's channel, and it was an interview between the then Tory MP for Burton-on-Trent, Ivan Lawrence, and Ian McKellen. And Ian McKellen was effectively, it was about whether the age of consent should be raised from, mm-hmm, 16. And his argument was, well, if people are gay, you know, don't penalise them for doing what a heterosexual,
yeah,
person,
absolutely,
who knows that they're not gay is able to do at the same age. And Ivan Lawrence's response was one of, well, his constituents, middle class people, normal people, I think, I don't know if he actually used the word normal, wouldn't feel comfortable because it would be, if you're 16, then really you're being pressured. You're clearly being pressured by somebody older. And so this whole perspective was based on what was going on in his head.
Yeah, absolutely.
I mean, it's sort of like, okay, you have a problem with it, but the whole point here is that there are some people who are very comfortable mm-hmm. in their own skin. And what's it got to do with middle-class people who in your constituency? You know, it's like, well, actually, they don't need to know.
No, they don't need to know at all. It's none of their business.
Yeah.
And they would be the first to be up in arms if the same curtailment was being placed upon them or their children. You know, yeah. And yeah, it's just ridiculous. It becomes a farce.
Yeah.
You know, it's none of your business. Just mind your own business.
What about earliest memories? Because obviously Northern Ireland is somewhere that you grew up. And you go back to Ireland, don't you?
I
sort of often, you know, visit family and so on. And I'm fascinated with the whole punk question as well, because I remember at the time of the conference that I met you in, and you know what I'm going to say, we were having this long conversation about Fergal Sharkey.
Yes.
But that may or may not come up. Yeah. But it's sort of like, you know, I really liked a good heart. It's like, well, you know, a certain, you know, you don't say that.
Yeah.
So, you know, the interview will stop right now. No. But but earliest memories, how far can you go back?
So my earliest memory, I think I'm about two. I'm in my grandparents' house, my paternal grandparents, and I'm looking upwards. The record player is, the fireplace is in the middle, and then there's the record player, and then the TV at a funny angle. And I'm watching my grandmother put a record on, which is Boney M, Brown Girl in the Ring. A good 70s classic, if ever there was one. And then, I don't remember the music starting, because I don't remember that crackle and the hiss, because it was a little 7-inch. But I remember her dancing. I remember watching her face, and I could still see how excited she was by this song, how much she enjoyed moving to it, and how much this song meant to her, in a very simple way. She was a very simple woman, but yeah, that's my earliest memory. It's one of my happiest memories as well. But in terms of Northern Ireland itself, my earliest memory is actually of my mum, and we were going through Belfast. I was young enough to be in a buggy, so I don't know what age I was, but I was young enough to be in a buggy. And the reason I remember that is we went through the Ring of Steel, which was the fences that they had all around. And as you come through the Ring of Steel, there's the blockade where they search you. And it's solid metal, but it reflects. And I can remember looking over and seeing the buggy and not quite understanding if that was me or not. And then being freaked out because I could see my mum and couldn't see her head. Her head was above the barrier. So that's sort of my earliest memory of the Troubles, is going through the Ring of Steel and my mum losing her head. She frequently lost her head around me, I have to say. But for other reasons. So yeah, I remember that. Most of it, kind of the Troubles were just the background, if that makes sense, because it was just your normal everyday. You know, so you would switch on the news, there's been a bomb here, there, wherever. Somebody's been shot, somebody's been... So that was very normal. I thought everyone was like that. And it wasn't until, embarrassingly, it wasn't until I came over to university that I realised that's not normal. Mm. And I remember, and slightly embarrassed about it, but I remember coming over, and the very first time I walked into the shopping centre by myself, I stood with my arms out, waiting to be searched. Because that's what you did, you got searched. I was blocking everybody from getting in from the door. And eventually this old security guard, who was about 300, came over. And he says, "Can you move, love?" "No, you haven't searched me yet." He said, "You're blocking the doors." "But you need to hurry up then, don't you?" And he said, it was just complete cognitive dissonance. I didn't know what I was supposed to do. He didn't know what I was talking about. And so, yeah, thing.
It's funny because I came to that from the other angle. I went to Belfast in 2006 for a conference at Queen's University. And it was a criminology conference, and a lot of the people who were in the audience, as I later discovered, had been released under the Good Friday Agreement. They were former IRA prisoners. And I assumed that everybody in the audience was an academic, and so I had some very interesting conversations over tea and biscuits, sort of very, you know. But what I do remember most, though, is that in the room that we were in, because it was Queen's University, there was a picture of the Queen on the walls, and I thought it very curious that you had former IRA prisoners and the picture of the Queen. But I noticed it because I was the outsider, and when I mentioned this afterwards, it was like, well, yeah, that's it's Queen's University, but it, you know, for me it seemed almost I say inappropriate, but it was the discontinuity. It was something that, you know, I wasn't used to seeing in an English university, for example. So for me, going to Belfast, it was a fascinating experience, but I did kind of feel that there was all this history that I knew very little about, and I kind of felt a little bit out of my depth, I think, really.
Right, interesting.
That was, 2006.
Yeah, I mean, I've never walked into university over here and seen a picture of the Queen. Or anybody, actually. But yeah, Queens have them. You know, if you were to go around the University of Ulster, they don't. You know, because it's not the Queen's University. It's just the University. And it's only at Queen's that you get that. Even Stranmillis, they don't have it. Which is the big teaching college just down the hill from Queen's. They don't have it either. It's just Queen's. And everyone just seems to accept that. But yeah, it does. It's like you were bringing in former IRA members or potentially not former IRA members, as some of them will likely have been, you think you would take that down? You know, out of respect for the fact that, you know, we're all going to be in a space together, let's make everybody in some way comfortable.
But we were talking earlier about the category of religion and how it's perceived, perhaps in a lay context, you know, in terms of straight edge punks, or certainly my experience then was that I was told afterwards that some of the people listening were quite fidgety, felt very uncomfortable when I was talking about religion, because for them, religion was very much, as IRA prisoners, there were Protestant guards in the prison, and they saw this disconnect. So religion was something that was very much a sort of a power tool.
Yeah.
And they was be looking at the concept of redemption, which was started in my PhD, but without that sort of you know, political or social context. So it was a great, I learned so much from those two or three days that I mean,
religion as a category in Northern Ireland is used as a political tool even to this day, and you're seeing it with Brexit as well. But, you know, both sides, and it really was both sides, would often say that the other would, well, they're not true. You know, they're not true religion, or they're not a true believer. And what they mean is it's incorrect. You know, that's not how I understand faith. And once you can start to pull that apart, then it becomes really fascinating. What do you mean by faith? You know, because you had people in the IRA and you had people in the UVF who held extremely strong religious beliefs. Traditionally understood religious beliefs. One of the very high up people in the IRA, for example, wouldn't use condoms as the timer on a bomb, because condoms and contraceptive teaching is against the Catholic Church. Yet didn't seem to have any issue with the fact that you're still using a bomb. You know, there was issues like that. There were people who if you met them on the street, you would think you were fundamentalist, evangelical, Protestant Christians. But they're high up in the UVF or the UFF or the UDA. You know, and they don't seem to have a disconnect between that. So what do we talk about when we talk about religion? You know, it means all these different things to all these different people. We can't take it away from politics. We can't take it away from history. We can't take it away from memory. It's all of these things, and they make us who we are. But we bring those assumptions, and then we apply them to other people, and Northern Ireland is unfortunately one of the examples of when that goes very wrong. Although there's obviously colonial history and imperial rule and the British Army and everything else tied up within the wider troubles, but a lot of it is to do with the assumptions. Just to give you a very quick example, when I did it, I grew up in the 80s and the 90s, and there was the rule on the BBC, you couldn't show the voice of terrorists. So Gerry Adams was always blocked out, and they always had the actor do his voice, and you never saw his face. And I can remember as a child being so confused by this, and thinking, he must be a monster. Why else would you not have him on television? He must be a monster. So in my head, that all Catholics became monsters. And then when we were allowed to see it, I was so disappointed. He's look normal. I was really, really disappointed.
And I think that one of the, it may have been Channel 4, but one of the TV companies got around it, but they either had the most perfectly sort of blended lip syncing that we didn't know whether it was an actor's voice or Gerry Adams's,
right.
And I think that was deliberate, or indeed they were already saying, we're going to defy this rule, because it was right that we could hear the words, but you couldn't hear the voice.
Couldn't hear the voice. So the guy, it was always an actor, and not always a Northern Irish actor, so it was quite often Scottish. He would read out whatever he'd said. And you could also put it towards, especially in the 90s, you could put it in the subtitles as well. You know, where you was it teletext?
That's right, yeah.
See factors from
888.
Yeah, so you can have that up. See, this is a ludicrous law. Yeah. And the fact is, you only applied it to one side. You know, you didn't apply it to members of the church. And yet, you know, they were just as complicit. You didn't apply it to members of the British Army. You know, they were just as complicit. So it was a very one-sided rule.
Mm.
You know, it is about, it's about power.
So in terms of, you know, the question of what you enjoyed doing or what you remember doing as a child, looking back, it must, so much of what you grew up with must seem very quite surreal now in terms of the way things have moved on politically. But I mean, you know, you've just highlighted something that at the time did feel very odd.
Yeah.
Even obviously, you know, just watching this in Wales and, you know, Gerry Adams, and it was almost like, but because it was also drawing attention,
yes,
to it,
it was.
And so it kind of felt that it was backfiring.
Yeah.
Because, you know, we won't give the terrorist the voice, but in but giving him this peculiar voice, yes, absolutely, yeah. And that became the issue.
Yeah. I look back on my own childhood with great happiness. I had a brilliant childhood. I had very young parents, so they were physically capable of taking us out, and we were taken out all the time. We didn't have any money. We grew up below the poverty line. So when I say we were taken out, you know, we'd go into the forest. But then my dad would have the rule of, well, you're not allowed to walk on the path. And then my mum would yell at him, because, of course, your shoes are going to come home mucky and all the rest. You know, but we had a lot of fun. We enjoyed doing things. It was very imaginative play. So that's kind of what I meant when I said earlier that it's very much in the background. So it's probably surreal when you tell stories, but at the time it didn't.
At the time it was
surreal.
Normal, but looking back, that, yeah, sort of that disparity.
Yes, you know, so you could be somewhere and then all of a sudden you had to go home, and nobody had a say, and you just knew, all right, okay, there's a bomb scare, so everybody goes home. So things like, but also people just did very normal things, like, for example, 94, something like that, I was in hospital. I was born with scoliosis, so I had to, it caused deformed feet, and I had to have operations so I could walk. And one of them, it was in Musgrave Hospital, which is next to, I think it was the RAF base. So a bomb went off, they were trying to get Diana. And so there was all this carry on. And my granny, the one that I remember from playing the music, her and my grandfather came up to visit me. And I can remember her utter disappointment, because she'd just found these, do you remember Mars and Snickers brought out the, I think it was still Marathon back then,
yes,
they brought out the ice cream versions?
Yes.
She thought these were fantastic, and she brought them up, and she was so disappointed because of the bomb scare, it took so long to get through, that they'd melted.
They'd melted, yeah.
And it's just like daft little things like that, but yet there is that sort of more serious side behind it. But it's the human part of it that you remember.
Yeah, I remember lots of railway evacuations,
yes,
in Birmingham a few times.
Yeah, Liverpool.
Yes, and even in Swansea, I remember there was a period when the lockers were taken, mm-hmm, or the bins and the lockers were,
yeah,
taken away on the platform. So if you had luggage,
yeah,
you couldn't leave them.
You put, that's, yeah, where they put the bombs, put them, yeah, in the bins. That was after the one in Warrington.
That's right,
they,
that was 93,
the two
little,
yeah, boys, yeah. They, yeah, took away all the... Because they're only starting to bring the bins back now. I don't know if you've noticed.
Mm.
But now they're all clear see-through bins.
That's right.
So you can see if somebody puts a bomb in them, or they have those they also have those coverings, so you can only fit in with your rubbish, and that's it. You know, so yeah, we they say, okay, the terrorism level's gone down in regards to Northern Ireland, but actually, they're being very careful. They're being incredibly careful with things. So I'm not convinced that they think it has really gone down. Because it is the clear bins or it's the plastic.
You see,
bins.
I didn't see that because at work I'm very conscious now that sometimes I have to put some things in the recycling,
yeah,
bin. And of course, I always think now that if I then put the wrong thing, that it'll be obvious what I've done, and there's CCTV. So actually, it's more like, but ecologically, actually,
yeah,
you know, it makes me more environmental,
yeah,
because I'm aware that I can't just like randomly,
yeah,
put something in a bin. But I will actually be, you know, on camera and,
yeah,
and subsequently fined, you know, for doing that, scolded. What about musically? What sort of memories do you have growing up? Because obviously punk is shaped you hugely, but in terms of what you remember, earliest memories or growing up, I mean, did the charts, for example, have any particular influence on you in terms of what you used to listen to or share with friends?
No, not really. What the? So my parents didn't overly listen to music. I sort of vaguely recall bits and pieces. My dad liked Slade. Yeah, we'll talk about that later. My mum, I know she liked David Essex, because my dad did her a painting of David. My dad is an amazing artist. He did her a painting of David Essex. I don't remember her playing any of that. I remember her playing classical music. And it was one of those things of, you'd watch her, and it was obvious that she felt she had to play that, rather than this is being played for enjoyment. But one of the things that we had, and I utterly adored it, was the original vinyl of The War of the Worlds. Do you remember the one that they released? Jeff Austin?
Jeff Wayne?
Yeah. David Essex is in it and various. We had that, and I used to play that over and over and over again. I loved all the different voices. At some point we had Tolkien on vinyl. I still love Tolkien. We had a production of that. I think it was from the BBC. But apparently, I don't remember doing this, but all older people tell me I did this. From I was able to stand up in the cot, I used to jump up and down if you played the radio to the music. And my favourite was Status Quo. I used to jump up and down. And my first words were yummy-like, which is I liked. Which I think in one of their songs they have, I like it, I like it,
oh,
I like it.
Yeah, rocking all over the world.
Yeah, so
yeah.
I think I was trying to say that, yummy-like. Yeah. And I used to jump up and down endlessly to that.
So when Live Aid came on, that was the first song. You must have been your element. Yeah, I think I still do that today. I think the radio comes on. Yeah. I still jolt up and get very, very excited. Yeah.
No, there was five of us. There's five of us siblings, and we all like different music. But it was a 2-bedroom house that we lived in. Sometimes it was less. So we would all try and outplay each other with music as well.
By literally turning the volume up.
Yeah, by turning the volume
up. What's the punk connection?
What do you mean?
Because obviously your research is on straight edge punk.
Yes.
And how did your interest in punk come about?
John Peel. I used to listen to the radio at night with John Peel used to play. And I can remember, it was The Clash. He played The Clash and it was just phenomenal. But I didn't overly get into that kind of punk because I didn't know where to find it. Mine was the early 90s stuff. So Green Day, AFI, those kind of bands, largely American, but very, very accessible. And then my uncle's only a few years older than me, my mum's brother, he's only a few years older than me, he gave me some of his music, which was Stiff Little Fingers, Rudy, The Outcasts, like proper Northern Irish punk, The Clash, The Sex Pistols and all of that. Some of it's still sitting down there in proper vinyl form, still well listened to. And then some of the more gothy punk stuff, Joy Division, New Order, Bauhaus, Fields of the Nephilim. I just loved it. I absolutely loved it. I loved the anger. I loved the way they could express political ideas. I wasn't as drawn to how they looked. I liked the more gothy look. I just thought there was something beautiful about it. The punk look came a bit later for me. Mm-hmm. But yeah, I loved the sound. I loved the politics. I liked the way that they expressed their views on in animal rights. So a lot of punks were very involved with things like hunt sabbing, still are, which it's not illegal over here, but it is in Northern Ireland. It's considered a terrorist activity in Northern Ireland and can be punished under the Terrorist Act. So they were putting themselves on the line for what they believed in very specific ways. And I've actually subsequently done interviews with people that were involved with it. And they've told me that quite often the people who are performing the hunt would hire the UDA to come and do bodyguards because they were so fed up with these sabs. So there was kind of all of that going on at the same time as well. The charts not so much. The next sister down from me, she liked Kylie Minogue, Backstreet Boys, that kind of thing. And then the one below that, she'll hate me for saying it, she loved E17. That was she had a remember the old 3-hour and then you got the 6-hour VHS things that you'd record.
Yeah.
She got a hold of the 6-hour one. She recorded one of the E17 songs over and over and over again. For the full 6 hours. It was the
Is it the Christmas one, Stay?
The one about where it's about his brother that committed suicide. I've forgotten what the song said, yeah. And then she would play that incessantly.
It's interesting because my sister definitely Hazel O'Connor. Susie and the Banshees, very, very, artist that she went through a period, Toya Wilcox as well. So punk was certainly sort of very much, not for me, 1981, that sort of period, hugely sort of...
UK 82?
But that was UK 82?
UK, it was the second wave of punk. Is known as UK 82, cause that sort of, and that was your very aggressive, the Conflict, UK Subs. Those sort of, they were very much inspired by Crass, those kind of much more overtly anarchist bands than the Sex Pistols or the Clash had been.
So it sounds like a real diverse set of musical influences in your family. So you weren't all listening to the same thing
and
you actually clearly were contesting and outplaying and trying to outmaneuver each other's musical
and some of that is simply too many people in a very small house and people trying to find their place in the order within the family and so on. But my parents were very tolerant in ways that
have those tastes
are impressive.
Evolved. I mean, in terms of your relationship with your siblings, have they evolved? Has there been? Do you still continue to sort of listen to very sort of divergent things?
Yes.
You have. Okay, because I found with my sister sometimes that I'd be very intrigued by some of the stuff she was listening to. And then we'd almost like get it later. She was at one point really into Carly Simon, and then I went through a period when I was really into Carly Simon, but by that point she'd moved somewhere else. I was like, well, hang on a minute, I'm trying to catch up with you here, but at least let's just, it'd be nice to have a little period when we can both listen at the same time.
The next one down from me, number two, she doesn't listen to music at all, unless she was travelling somewhere, and then she will put on, I don't know how to describe it, it's like old 70s stuff. But she puts it on because she knows my parents won't like it. It's not necessarily what she would like. She listens to country music, not because she likes country music, she likes their voice. She likes the way they talk, the kind of country yokel. She thinks that's funny. But she wouldn't consciously listen to music in the house by herself. She wouldn't put anything on. The next two, their music tastes have now become quite similar. So E17 is no longer in the picture. They would be sort of what I would call indie music. They would, so Oasis, that kind of thing. And then the last one, who's quite a bit younger than the rest of us, so there was four of us in 5 years. And then there's a 9-year gap, and then the youngest. And he listens to kind of bits of all that we listen to. So if I'm around, he'll put on The Clash, put on the Sex Pistols, he'll happily listen to them. If my other brother's around, he'll put on The Strokes or The Hives, that kind of thing. So he's quite malleable and adaptable, ironically. He has Asperger's. But musically, he would be. My dad, he still sings what he sings. So he learns about two lines from songs and then just repeats them over and over again. Except for Slade, he loves Slade.
Yeah, no, it's I find the way that our musical tastes sometimes define us to be very indicative, but also to the point that sometimes, decades on, it's hard to shake those initial pleasures, shall we say. And I find that it's quality proof. In some cases, I still listen to the same music, and it's irrelevant whether I like it or not. Yeah. It's because it's so in as part of my DNA that I kind of get very excited by a lot of those retro radio programs.
Yeah, absolutely.
Where they're, because in a way it's my childhood that's being evoked in those 3-minute hits.
Yeah, one of the fun things that me and the one next to me does is we'll find the little jingles that were on the 80s kids cartoons, the Gummy Bears and the Thundercats. We don't want to watch the cartoons, we want the jingle. It's because it's exactly what you say, it's a reliving and a of your childhood and of a fun memory, and you share it with the person that was there with you when you did that.
Well, I went through a period, it would have been autumn 1988, and I used to record, and I got a whole 45 minute side of a cassette of this, of just recording the jingles off the radio with maybe like a couple of, for example, I'd record the last couple of seconds of a news bulletin knowing that a jingle would follow. And it's and I heard this back a few months ago, about a year ago, and I thought, this sounds, I knew that I'd done that, it's not that I'd forgotten that I'd done it, but I put it up on Facebook or Mixcloud, I think, and suddenly a whole community of jingle lovers, and I've been sent all of these compilations people have made from the 60s and 70s, from pirate radio, from a whole range of stations, BBC and commercial.
That's huge,
and now for my nostalgia interviews, I'm trying to get a jingle commissioned. And I was asked to give an example of the sort of jingle I want. And I had to sort of say, well, okay, well, I know what I want and you've asked me. So it was all sort of like, and I managed to dig out all these old sort of early 90s Radio 2 jingles with sometimes very corny lyrics, but utterly of a time and place. And those jingles told a story. Mm-hmm. Those jingles, very much in the space of 5 seconds, they were identical. You know, a pop song can do the same. You mentioned Kylie Minogue. I mean, you love it or hate it, it sort of evokes a particular period. But those jingles would do the same in literally a matter of seconds. Yeah. They were identity labels. They told you who the presenter was, the station, and also the music would, the sound of the jingle would vary according to the type of program. You know, some of them might be more country, some of them might be more classical, some of them might be more pop or synth-like. And that would also give you a flavour of the corresponding program. So
Channel 4 was really the only television program that managed to do that with their own logo. And they had the music that worked. BBC One keep trying, and theirs get more elaborate in terms of visually, but they haven't worked out the music because the music doesn't work with theirs. But Channel 4 got it right, that sound that they had, you know, and even today, you know, they haven't really changed it. It works. You know, something's coming on. I'll pay attention for a few moments to see what it's going to be.
I was having a conversation, actually, somebody else who I've interviewed in the series, who said that for him, when he watches old programmes that he's recorded off the television, it's the adverts sometimes that are far more exciting.
Absolutely.
Because what do they say about those are the clothes that people wore? Those were the things people were buying. Yep. Petrol was how much? You know, whatever it was. But again, you learn far more. And at the time, you just thought, oh, this is a silly advert.
Well, I have one. I actually ended up using it in a lecture. So I found it on an old VHS. I was looking to see if we could record over it for... We wanted to record my nephews at the time. And it was Mr. Bean. Somebody had taped Mr. Bean. The Rowan Atkinson one, not the new animated one. And in the midst of it, so this must have been before the Belfast Agreement, but in the midst of it is the confidential hotline advert. And there is this whole thing with, by law, because anyone who's lived through a civil war is considered to be traumatised, whether you are or not. And therefore you are in some way immune to graphic suggestion. So adverts legally can be a lot more brutal than they would be allowed to be over here. So this was clearly put out for children, and it tells the story of this baby is born, the dad is locked away in prison, clearly involved with paramilitaries. He gets released, and you see him with his son. He buys his son a football. He can't play with his son because he has to go off when he commits. So he's the driver. And the guy that he's driving, everybody knew who he was. And they went in and shot up the bar. Now, that was an actual event. This guy walked in, shouted Happy Halloween, shot up the bar. So he gets put back in prison. And then his son grows up without him there. And he becomes paramilitary as well. And he shoots someone else with their son stood next to them. And it's very, very graphic. And eventually the son is killed. It's assumed through what's put in the advert that they're killed through reprisal. And then the strap line is, don't suffer it, change it. And as soon as it came on, and a few of us were sat in the room, we were all, oh, I remember that song, that song was class. And there was no sense of, actually, that was horrific. Why were we made to watch that as children? It was the music, it was the jingle, it was that moment in time. So I ended up using it in a lecture, but you know, this is what we were shown, and this is what the troubles were like, but this is actually very ordinary. So when I show it in the lecture, I always make them see the last little bit of Mr. Bean. It's like, this is ordinary for people. And it goes back into Mr. Bean. And that was considered appropriate for children.
Mm. Because we were talking earlier about, before we were recording, about Live Aid. In fact, indeed, in relation to Status Quo, opening Live Aid, of course. But Bob Geldof didn't want Live Aid to be recorded. Mm. But I know that there is a version that you can now watch. And I bought the DVD in 2004. But interestingly, my memory of Live Aid is not just the acts performing, but having the radio on as well as the TV continuity presenters. I remember Andy Kershaw and Richard Skinner and was it David Hepworth? And what I remember is all the links. And this was like an incredible day. And it was sort of like, how do we, with all these 72,000 people in Wembley Stadium and billions of people around the world, how do they possibly communicate that?
Yeah.
And for me, the way that the presenters were able to sort of get a measure of the day and who they chose, they often were the Radio 1 presenters to do all the continuity material. That for me is my memory of the day. Rather, and the way that they introduced the act and looked forward to Brian Ferry going on or Queen or U2, and that for me is far more memorable, perhaps, or rather the acts in themselves were obviously pivotal in what happened on that day.
Yeah.
But I think if you take away, if you just see the acts perform and you don't have the context in which it originally appeared, I think you lose something valuable, and that's exactly how I feel about jingles.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, I agree. Yeah. I mean, my memory of that, as we were saying earlier, is watching the event as a it was reported on Newsround.
Yeah.
You know, I don't remember the event. I presume I didn't watch it. I presume I was out playing, because I was that, just that little bit too young. But, you know, it was enough to then get my interest, because, as I said, you know, I then insisted that we had to watch Top of the Pops, because I wanted to see it. I assumed it would be on Top of the Pops. You know, and, yeah, so many memories of childhood are tied up with that. You know, Christmas Day, for example, we never watched the Queen's Speech. My family are Protestant. Some of them very loyalists, so. But we never watched the Queen's Speech. We always watched Top of the Pops.
Yeah.
That's what you watch on Christmas afternoon. You watch Top of the Pops. Who's going to be Christmas number one?
Yeah.
And even if you hated the song, you still had to know.
Yeah. You know? And even though Top of the Pops finished in 2006, it's still on every Christmas day.
Yeah, it is. Yeah. It is still on every Christmas day. Admittedly, we know. And we now go for the Muppet Christmas Carol, which itself has great jingles. Yeah.
How did, and actually it's funny you mentioned The Muppet Christmas Carol, because that won the award at work. We had this poll, which is the best Christmas film, and
it is,
and that was number one by
a long margin.
What, how did you end up then in academia? I know you said that you were a teacher at one point,
yes.
but how did you follow the path that you are now on?
I did my degree at Scarborough, and then I did a year at York doing a PGCE, or PGD, or whatever they're called. And then I taught high school for 7 years. So I taught initially for a year in Scarborough, then in Belfast for a year, and then in Manchester for 5 years. And then my sister realised that her youngest son is profoundly disabled. And so it became more convenient that I would live in Scotland. But Scotland can be a bit awkward with these things, and they don't accept English teaching qualifications at the time. So I thought, well, if I did a master's, that would supersede that anyway. That's what I'll do. So I did a master's at Glasgow with Ward. And during the master's, Ward Blanton suggested that I should consider a PhD. I have to be honest, I didn't even know what a PhD was, because I was the first one in my family to go to university, but I was also the first one in school to go from my friendship groups. There was nobody in the estate that I grew up with that went. So I didn't have those people around me that would have known such things, but I didn't really know what it was. I understood it was a terminal degree, and I understood that's what you had to get to be a professor, and that was about the extent of my knowledge, so I had to do some research, and I never told Ward that. I got interested in that idea, and Ward was very encouraging, so he said you should go and see some conferences, see what academics do. And he tried to make that happen. He was really good. I went to the Scottish University's postgraduate conference via him and things like that. And then I think it was maybe Ward. I can't remember. No, Ward then suggested that I do it in America because I wanted to do it in punk. I wanted to look at punk as this category of religion, and he thought that would suit the way in which sociology of religion is taught there. So I did make some inquiries, and I was given some offers to be fully funded. And then somebody said, you should actually look at Stirling. Andrew Haas is there, who does really good stuff on culture. So I got in touch with Andrew, and he agreed to meet me. He was on research leave at the time. He was on research leave and was based in Glasgow, because I think he was writing a book with Heather Walton or something like that. So he met me at the university. And I was kind of chatting through ideas, and he was very easygoing. And he said to me, I don't understand anything that you're telling me in terms of straight-edge punk. I've never heard of this. I don't know any of these bands. Tell me five bands I should look up, and that will explain straight-edge to me. So, of course, I did that, and then some more. And he immediately looked them up. And I was so impressed that he would do that, that rather than saying, well, actually, I'm just about the ideas, you know, the fact that this clearly matters to you, so I'll look up this. And then he suffered through the music. He played them and he dutifully listened. So that was my decision of, actually, I'd rather work with him than go to these fully funded places in the US. So that took me to the PhD, which I started that in 2008 and I finished in 2011. And then I worked as a teaching fellow in the University of Stirling for 5 years, and now I'm the Implicit Religion Research Fellow at Bishop Gross Test since September.
Yeah. And in terms of your time at university, we've already covered things like music, but film, sports, politics, religion, I guess. You've obviously been studying in different institutions, yes. In different countries in that sense and all that. But what sort of impact did that have? I mean, did your interests or musical tastes or interest in film, for example, evolve at all during that period? And, you know, politics and religion, which obviously a huge part implicitly, you know, in your growing up. How was that factored in, especially in terms of the research that you're now doing, where you're almost sort of, you know, very critically looking at some of these terms and categorising them?
The punk thing stayed fairly stable. That was sort of always my identity. That's who I always identified as. It did shift in terms of how I presented myself, so I didn't always look overtly punk, and I think that part of that is ageing as well. There isn't much work done on ageing, particularly around women, in regards to the punk community. There needs to be. Laura Way is doing some fantastic work on that. But I think identity does shift in terms of how women present themselves anyway. But the actual core identity didn't shift at all. If anything, I think as I went through universities and realised how apathetic students had become, because I have very, very vague memories of the miners' strike and seeing them, people on television, and being utterly fascinated that something mattered to somebody so much that they were willing to strike. And I didn't fully understand the poverty that particularly the women were facing back then. I came to understand that later. But then I got to university, you know, the late 90s, and there was nothing. You know, there was a Star Trek club, and there was, I think, a wall climbing club or something like, you know, it was, the lack of politics really got to me. So I think my own quite hardened in that sense of, well, if you're not going to do it, I will. And then I enjoyed films. I love Star Wars. I love Lord of the Rings. And I tend to be the type of person, if I like something, I will go to it repeatedly rather than broadening out. But I was asked to take a course, to teach a course, at Stirling on religion and representation. And I suddenly realised all of those things that I like, I can notice all these things about religion about it. So I read your work. I read Brent Plate's work on religion and film. I was already familiar with Gordon Lynch in terms of music, so I looked at some of his film stuff. And then I got kind of introduced to all these genres that I don't necessarily personally enjoy, film noir and stuff like that. But the way in which they deal with the category of religion is fascinating. And I enjoyed doing that with the students. But it's one of those things you can't switch it off now. So at the minute I'm watching Daredevil, Marvel's Daredevil, which is, sit quietly because I don't want my nephew to hear, but it's appalling. I'm not a superhero fan, but they've made him Catholic, and it's really interesting to see how they put that forward visually on the screen. So Daredevil is all filmed in liturgical colours. You know, he's quite overt about being Catholic, and very occasionally you'll just see him do not the full sign of the cross, but just little hints of it before he starts fighting, you know, things like that. So the idea of faith, it comes through in really interesting ways. But I think you can't kind of switch that off.
No, and I remember an article, actually while I was doing the PhD, it was Bruce David Forbes, and he wrote about...
Oh yes, did Religion in America, yes.
Yeah, and I think he was talking about how he found cartoons, maybe it was to do with a family member, a son maybe, who was really into cartoons, and he thought, well, I'm a religious studies professor, this isn't the thing that, you know, is part of my research. But he watched them, mm-hmm. and then found that actually the exactly on the lines of what you just said, with all the sort of cruciform poses, and because I did my PhD in redemption and film, and I found that very interesting, that it was almost sort of rather than about how does religion appear, you know, in film, but it was actually the opposite. It was more about the use, maybe in a more implicit sort of context, the use of religious imagery, but in a context that was not liturgical, wasn't ecclesiastical, wasn't confessional.
And again, with the Marvel thing, you know, they've put that out, and for most people, they'll not pick up on that, you know, because Marvel is aimed at, I think, 8 to 12-year-old boys. So they're not going to pick up on the fact, oh, that's liturgical colours. Oh, why have they gone with purple? Why have they gone with red? What are they trying to say? You know, they're just going to enjoy, oh, he's hitting him and he's hitting him and she's flipping around on whatever she's doing. You know, and that's fine. You can enjoy it at that level. But yeah, there is that thing of you start to notice these things. And it adds that new layer of depth and new layer of appreciation. And think, actually, a lot of these people that make these films in the background are so clever at what they're doing. And they're tapping into this conversation that we all want to have. And what do we mean when we talk about religion? What do we mean when we place religion in things that are not traditionally considered religious? And who gets to design that? And where do these demarcations appear? You know, there's all sorts of really interesting ways that happens.
Mm. And back to what you were just saying as well about how students in the late 90s didn't seem to be interested in political questions. I mean, my sense as well, I remember teaching a mature student in around 2001 who said that when she did a first degree in the 60s, she said everybody was politically active, everybody was going on marches and strikes. And she said by the time she returned and did a second degree in the early 2000s, she said nobody really cared, nobody was active. I think that's changed now, it has in the last few years, but certainly a decade ago. I remember once with my students, we were using a few analogies before, it was the 2010 election, and I really got the sense that, you know, my points were not really gelling or engaging. I think now things would be a bit different, and I've had some quite heated political comments or views expressed by students in a class.
Yeah, absolutely, yeah. I mean, the Scottish independence, the vote for that, then Brexit, you know, students have become engaged, but I think we've perhaps, because we come from a pre-social media generation, our understanding of activism is perhaps not theirs. You know, so for them, activism, I don't agree with it, but for them, activism is signing a petition online. And actually, there is value in that. Those petitions have real meaning, particularly if it's one that's for Parliament. But for me, activism is standing and shouting and yelling and hunt-sabbing and that sort of thing. You know, so maybe there's a conversation that needs to be had and an understanding needs to be had with our generation of actually those things have shifted. It doesn't mean that they're missing. It doesn't mean that they're apathetic. It means that they're just different. And perhaps we're being too nostalgic in that sense. You know, I expected this hotbed of revolution and I didn't get it. I got Scarborough, which is lovely, you know, but nobody was involved with anything. There was no political activism, but then maybe there just wasn't anything that people felt they needed to protest, you know, and students are engaged in different ways now.
Yes, I think there was a period when the common cry, certainly in the 90s and early 2000s, people would say, oh, well, all politicians are the same. There's no point voting. You're going to get the same thing. Because I don't think people are saying the same thing anymore.
No, I don't think they are.
And you mentioned the miners' strike. Yes. I mean, the country was polarised in 1984 in a way that it is now over Brexit. But go back 10, I think it's the Iraq War, actually. Yes, that did. People went to the street. But that, and there was the poll tax. That was in 1990. But in the years in between, which was when I was growing, I first voted in 92. There wasn't anything on that sort of scale to get to actually motivate people on the streets in the same sort of way that we're seeing now aplenty.
Yeah, I think I do wonder at times, is it also because you've come from Northern Ireland, we will protest the opening of an envelope if you want. We'll just protest that for the love of protesting. You know, I remember protesting against Margaret Thatcher, where they burned effigies of her. You know, so maybe there's a sense of that's what you grew up thinking, that's what protest should be, and it's not necessarily always effective. You know, it's not necessarily the right way to do something. So, yeah, there's considerations that perhaps need to be had.
Yeah. And you mentioned nostalgia a moment ago. A few more philosophically based questions to round off. But would you say, looking over the whole sweep of your life, but would you say that your memories are predominantly positive ones?
Yeah, I think I would. Yeah. I mean, I know there is a self-selection that goes on, you know, and it's much easier to remember the happy memories than the others. But for the most part, yeah, I think so. I'm by nature quite an optimistic person. But I think there is a level of realism as well.
Because I wonder sometimes, you know, whether it's possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences. And of course, there's the question about whether something, I mean, you mentioned growing up in Northern Ireland, that there were certain things that you took as just being normal that now looking back, you know, seem very strange.
Yeah.
What you said about, you know, the shopping centre with your arms outstretched. But do you think it's possible to be nostalgic about negative experiences because of the different spin that we put on it?
Yeah,
and
I think it is.
Well, we managed. We came through it. We were challenged and we overcame it.
Yeah, I mean, people who, you know, undergo huge trauma, you know, a lot of them still find meaning in it, you know, and they still say, well, actually, you know, I can look back on that and say, well, I survived, or I not only survived, I thrived, or whatever it may be. I mean, I gave you the example of being in hospital. You know, a lot of people consider that quite traumatic, but for me, it contains funny memories of my grandmother, and I now enjoy that because she died in March. So I enjoy those memories of the things that she did that were silly and daft and things. So, yeah, I think, yes, you can look back with nostalgia. You can look back with fondness. There's a comfort in it. It stops you from perhaps hiding from who you are, maybe, if that makes sense.
Yeah. Oh, no, it's definitely character building, isn't it? I mean, I've yet to meet anybody who says, yeah, every experience has been positive. Because, that would be...
Yeah, I mean, I think you were living in a bubble in that case.
Yes, I think. Well, for some people, you know, I suppose if the knives are in the wrong place in the drawer, then that's something to be upset about. Where other people, you know, they can be, you know, famines and earthquakes that will cause ruptures. But what about whether you have fulfilled, or do you think you will ever fulfil all the dreams and aspirations that you've had? In other words, I mean, you're still, well, you're younger than me, but do you
only
think,
a little.
Yeah, well, yeah, but do you think that you'll ever look back and think, there was something I really wanted to do, I haven't yet done it? Is there anything that you, career-wise perhaps, or not necessarily career-wise, anything that you kind of have this burning ambition to do, or used to have a burning ambition to do, and you kind of feel, is it too late?
There was a little part of me as a teenager really wanted to be a tattoo artist. I'm not a good enough artist, and nobody should let me near their skin, ever. I will make that disclosure now, but yeah, there's a little bit of me thinks, what if I'd stuck with the art? Because I did do art up to A level. There's a little bit of me thinks of that, but not enough that I would say it's a regret.
Mm-hmm.
It's a curiosity, but I think I'm very happy with what I've done.
So, and how old were you at the time? Did you say 15?
15,
16,
yeah.
So if somebody had told your 15-year-old self, or, you know, when you were 15, somebody had said, in 20, 30, whatever years' time, you're going to be a university lecturer, researcher, academic, what do you think your response would have been?
Well, at 15, my response to most things was to grunt at you, to be honest. I went through a phase at 15 of looking like Cousinette. So I would pull my hair in front of my face and just grunt at you. I think realistically, I probably would have laughed and said, but it's stupid, you know, catch yourself on. That would never have occurred to me as a career path. That was, I don't think I would even have really been aware that was a career. You know, obviously I was aware that people wrote books, and I read those books, some of them. You know, I was aware of that, but I wasn't aware of it as a career, you know. So no, I don't think it would have ever occurred to me at all. In that sense, no, I don't think I would have believed you. I like to think that 15-year-old me would be pleased. Well, who knows?
Yeah. And are you still in touch with many friends from your past?
I'm not really, but sort of. So some of them have shifted from friends to, they've become interviewees, and the relationship has shifted. A lot of that is because, you know, pre-mobile phone, no, you didn't stay in touch with people when you left the country. In terms of high school, no, not really. There's a few people on Facebook, and every now and then you're like, oh, yeah, you exist. Yes, hello, are you? And it's nice to see that they're doing well and you want them to do well, but beyond that, it's not a friendship, you know, and I have great concerns over the way in which Facebook and similar reconstruct the notion of friendship, because I think it's very false. And I think that gives people a very false sense of what it means to be a person. But no, not overly. I tend to be the kind of person of, I take my time to make a friend, and I make quite intense friendships, and they last. I have lots of mates and people that, you know, you're people I know. But in terms of friendships, they tend to last. So those are the most important to me. Not really from Northern Ireland. Just a couple. Yeah.
And my very last question: are you a looking back or a looking forward kind of person?
I don't know. That's a really good question. I think I do both. I enjoy looking back. Yeah, I enjoy it. There's pleasure in it. There's enjoyment in it. There's a lot of laughter at very bad fashion choices. There is a sense of enjoyment from nostalgia. I think there has kind of crept up in society the sense that we shouldn't have nostalgia. I mean, Trainspotting 2 was a really good example of actually nostalgia is right and we need it. And it's a key part of being or becoming middle-aged. But you have to do it honestly. And for me, to do it honestly means you have to also look forward. You have to look to the future and what's that going to be. And your past will inform that. So you can't not look back either. But yeah, I think it's a mixture of both.
Frances, it's been wonderful to catch up. Thank you very much.
Thank you.